Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And today we have sort of a interesting topic of discussion.
With an interesting structure of discussion.
Yes. So we're not talking about one specific game today, per se. We're talking about a aspect of board gaming and gaming in general. We're going to talk about, our thoughts on the subject and then maybe get into some details. But Matthew, what are we talking about today?
So we are talking about competitive board games. And I really want to quickly say that there is a distinction here. We are talking about competition. Normally when like we say competitive games in like our podcast, we were referring to just a game where there is a subset of winners, just most board games that are player versus player. But we today are specifically referring to games that have competitions, tournaments, things like that.
A competitive scene, if you will.
Yes, a competitive scene and player base.
And I guess I want to preface this real quick that board gaming YouTubers are becoming a thing. Obviously, there's board game review YouTubers that are very popular in the in the scene. But what I'm referring to are there's people that play board games competitively and they have very active YouTube accounts. I've specifically been watching videos from a YouTuber named Delighted or Dilighted. I think it's pronounced Delighted. And he does competitive Catan videos, and they are very entertaining and informational. And it inspired me to choose this topic of discussion for our episode. We're talking about games that have competitive scenes. I think the first thing we want to start out discussing is just like what it might take for a game to have a competitive scene. Because a lot of board game designers might design their game with the intention of there being a competitive scene, but I feel like there needs to be not only more to a game, but also more to like the meta game of a game in order for it to be a possibility and a healthy possibility at that. So let's start our discussion there.
Right.
So I guess, first of all, we could start with like, what does it take for a game to be competitive game design wise?
Right. Generally, it needs to have skill involved in winning. Not entirely deterministic, but usually the better player should win.
Mm-hmm.
You look at like the most extreme example of a random board game played competitively, which is poker. But that is a game where there are good players who consistently win, you know. So even something that's considered gambling because of how random it is still has a skill level.
Yes, I think part of that randomness needs to be measurable, like with probability. And that's why something like gambling, which has an incredible amount of randomness to it, has skilled players, is because a deck of cards is all about probabilities. If you know what you have and you can guess what your opponents have and you can see what's out in front of you, then you can make realistic assumptions of what cards will be drawn to finish out a hand of poker. So part of that, if there is randomness, does come with like being able to predict the randomness or mitigate it, or you know what I mean? At least read into it.
Yeah.
Predict it is probably, I think, the best way to put it.
Predict or manage or something similar.
Yeah. So if there is randomness, something to manage it is important. What else does a game need to be competitively viable? I feel like to be competitively viable, a one playthrough of a competitively viable game has to be pretty short, because repetition is important. Repetition leads to people learning more about a game and their skills improving. And also, if the game can be played multiple times in a row, then it can be, you know, hosted in sort of a tournament format.
Right. Yeah. I think it's interesting because Catan in particular tends to have slightly longer games, but it also supports more players per game. Whereas like most two player games, you know, chess, Magic, Go, those all have very short individual games.
Well, that's an interesting point, because at the highest level, games like chess and Go can have incredibly long games the players have enough time to think about their moves. I think it's important less so for like the very tournament play. If there's lots of players and need to whittle them down, and the only way to whittle them down is for them to finish games, then it helps for there to be a short game. But I think it's more important that the game is short, just so that any given player can play the game 100 times. And then after they played 100 times, they should have a deep understanding of the game and its mechanics that they could take to a tournament and put to the test.
Otherwise, I think a big part of a lot of competitive games is having like multiple strategies viable, sort of a player expression element to it.
Mm-hmm.
This is really common in video games with things like fighting games and strategy games where like different characters or classes will play differently. But it's also true in competitive tabletop games.
Sure. If you're like asking someone to devote themselves to a game, which is kind of what you're asking someone to do if you're asking them to take it seriously and play competitively, then you have to have some sort of buy-in for the player to attach themselves to. And one easy way of doing that is just having sort of like give the player the ability to forge their own identity in the game.
Right. Yeah.
Even when it comes to like chess, which has little player identity baked into the mechanics, there's still like opening strategy that players can identify with.
Right. Or even like Go, you can be more of an aggressive player, more of a safe player, more about territorial. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then I think the other sort of major thing, this is less about game design in particular. I guess one way to put it is readability is important. But this is more so as a way to help the game grow in popularity, because the biggest thing a game needs to have a competitive scene is players.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's worth considering sort of how you would want to grow a scene if you're designing a game to be competitive. I think part of it that definitely helps is like being able to sort of tell who's winning or who's losing. This is like a spectator thing, but also just, when you think about it, to get more people into the game, they have to see the game being played.
Yeah.
And so being able to see sort of the competitive aspect in a competitive game is useful. It's sort of a practical approach to spectatability. Just like supporting a competitive scene.
Right, so now we're getting more into like the metagame,
right?
And what a game's metagame has to look like in order to support some sort of competitive scene. I think definitely it needs to be spectator friendly to an extent, so that if somebody is watching the game being played at a game store or online, or just sees the game as a casual observer, they can follow it and at least become somewhat of a fan, or at least somewhat aware of how the game is played. So if they wanted to get into the league, they would have some entry point there. Or another way is just having an entry point available with how the game is designed or marketed or distributed or packaged or whatever. Just saying like having a starter kit maybe, or maybe having a set of rules to make a game easier to play the first time around to introduce a new player to the game. Something there so that the onboarding process for a new player is much smoother. Right. Because again, the thing that you need the most is tons of players playing your game.
Right. Nowadays, it helps to have streams of your tournaments or videos of your tournaments. Obviously, like Wizards does this, WizKids, Fantasy Flight do this, but I don't feel like I see many smaller, like, scenes stream their tournaments, except maybe, like, the Dominion scene. They stream at least their finals.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, it just sort of like an aspect of getting more people to see that the competitive scene exists. And as, like, a designer or a publisher, it's a good idea, I think, to at least promote these things if you're making a competitive game, even if you can't provide like a prize or anything, just helping signal boost them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, having a big social presence, or at least as big a social presence as you can, helps, you know, running your own community forum, like a Discord or a subreddit or both. Having active social media accounts that are constantly, you know, repping the people in the league just as much as the league itself or the competitive scene itself, is all very important. Just to show that, like, it's active, it's growing, it's cooperative, it's always asking people if they want to become a part of it.
Right. There's a certain point where, like, before you get to that point, the goal you have to solve is tell people that the scene exists. You know, like, I there's a lot of times where I've played a game and I've later, like, seen a tournament or something strategy-wise and been like, I didn't realize this game was played competitively.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to get people to play competitively, you have to sort of help them see that that exists in the first place.
Yeah, it's like before recently, the only way I would have ever found a competitive scene for any of the board games that I own was if I had gone to like a board game convention and there was some sort of side event for playing that game competitively. Otherwise, like, yeah, game stores don't really run competitive leagues, but maybe encouraging game stores to run competitive leagues of your game would make a nice, healthy, competitive scene.
I've done organized play events for Star Realms and what's it called? Red Dragon Inn. Mm-hmm. And those both had like one card promos provided by the developers. But that was enough to get the store to run an event. And also, yeah, just, I mean, just people, a small incentive people like were that. Excited to play the game, and that certainly helped.
Sure.
Yeah.
Let's see. I think one big thing in this day and age for getting a competitive scene healthily growing is having a digital version of the game that people can play and stream and record. I think I would never have heard of this competitive Catan YouTuber if I hadn't, if they hadn't created this, or if this one, how do I put it? It's like a free version of Catan you can play. And I'm not sure it's actually official, but it's called, I think it's called settlers.io or something like that. Yeah,
it's like a clone. If you will.
Yeah, it's a clone. But, you know, if that didn't exist, like a free to play version of a game with a simple interface that's easy to understand what's going on, then there probably wouldn't be as big a competitive scene. And certainly I wouldn't be able to learn about it and then talk about it on this podcast.
Right.
So having a digital version helps. Having a free digital version or an extremely cheap digital version of your game helps even more.
Again, I'm always surprised I can find games of Dominion online. Like, no matter what time of day it is, I can queue up and find a game.
Because making online sure,
client is so good.
Making sure you have users online and that they're trying to play games and making that accessible to new users is very good.
It's obviously like it's hard to make an online client all the time. But even like a, like tabletop sim support or something similar to that, or like you know, like what's it called? Splatter has I think it's Board Game Core, where they have all their games on. But like it's like a pretty primitive online version, but it's still something.
I think one thing that's interesting about competitive board gaming is that it seems like in competitive board gaming, especially when it's multiplayer, there's like a lot more table talk than other types of competitive gaming, if that makes sense.
Well, I think it's because you're watching Catan.
It might be because I'm watching Catan, but that's kind of an interesting thing that like board gaming is kind of a social thing where you get a group of people together to play this game and nothing in the rules says they can't work together. Catan obviously has a very big element with the trading resources with other players that incentivizes people to communicate, but I think that's also kind of an interesting thing that like if you can include that in your application, that can make for an even more interesting experience.
I think the games where table talk is used, it's because it's strategically viable. So Catan is because the trading aspect of the game is so crucial to like the resource gathering part. Mm-hmm. And then poker, because it's used as like a mind game.
Sure.
Because,
but I mean, if you want your game to be taken seriously, and you want people to like use every tool at their disposal to try and gain advantages, I don't think denying table talk is a bad thing. I think that that would be interesting if you could include that.
Right.
I think if you have like an online digital version of your game, at least having a chat window is important too.
Oh yeah.
I mean, Magic has like quick chat, so but that's still only 1v1. So when there's like multiple players and there's potential to work together, that could be interesting to have chat options.
Right.
To sort of sustain competitive play.
I have 2 points that are more for the community of the competitive game to help it become more popular or more widely known. One of them is having faces. I mean, like, pretty much every competitive scene has, like, content creators or people who are very good at showcasing the game. So, like, you mentioned Dilighted for Catan, but then, you know, compare that to, like, Cybertron for Pokemon, or Wolfie, I guess, for Pokemon as well, or, like, you know, how many League of Legends players there are that make videos about the game and, you know, post on YouTube their videos and stuff like that. Just having, like, a person that acts as sort of a figurehead is pretty useful.
Sure. If there's nobody like that in your scene, you could try and become that.
Yeah.
Make the content.
The other one
build the scene
is
that way.
The other,
or just promote ones that exist.
Yeah. The other is, like, strategy resources and guides. For like new players especially. You see this a lot with trading card games. There's a pretty big, not really industry, but field of like Magic and Yu-Gi-Oh! And Pokemon writers who write about the strategy for the games they play. But like, this is just sort of a good way to get people into the game, because you kind of have to assume that the people who are interested in playing the game competitively don't know the competitive terms and like concepts, and so getting people on board with those things is very important.
Yeah, if you want people to get into your game, then you need to like have you probably need to just manage your own database, like maintain a blog or a chat web board on your personal website for your game. Where people can talk strategy or post, you know, blog articles on high level play tips and tricks. Because, yeah, you make a good point that another part of, you know, becoming onboarded into a competitive scene for a game isn't just like knowing how to play it, but also knowing the prevalent strategies of the game.
Right.
And that's also a pretty good segue into the second part of this episode, where we get into a couple specific tips and tricks that we have for some of the competitive scenes that we are knowledgeable of. But is there anything else you want to talk about like what you can do to sustain a competitive environment?
Not necessarily. I think all of those kind of work together. Like if you're Twitch streaming, then having the content creator be a commentator is like fills multiple roles. Or like having strategic resources makes
Yeah, it makes it easier for people to get involved. Having a big public presence makes it more likely that someone sees you and takes an interest.
Right.
Being spectatable is good. And then having a digital platform so that people can play from any situation.
Right. Before we go into our respective competitive gaming hobbies, I do want to point out that chess has become super popular on Twitch lately. Mm-hmm. Not just with like people who play chess, but like a lot of big streamers are getting into it, and I think part of that is because chess has like very good online clients, very readable, a huge litany of strategy because it's chess, and it has like figureheads that are known for playing chess. You know,
right? Like I before, like if you asked me 5 years ago to name one chess grandmaster, like living chess grandmaster, I wouldn't be able to do it. And now I can name like five.
Yeah,
because there's so many different chess content creators that are being promoted to me. You know, via either the streamers that I watch. I think Team Solomid actually recently signed Hikaru as Hikaru one Nakamura. Of their Hikaru Nakamura as one of their content creators. So yeah, like organizations signing people. Twitch itself had sort of a chess theme situation a couple months ago. They had Twitch Rivals Pog Champs chess matches where they had famous streamers learn with grandmasters before going into a tournament. That's another thing is coaching could play a big part when you've identified who the skilled players are. Getting them to coach new players and get more people involved is also very helpful for a scene.
Right. Wolfie organized the same thing for Pokemon VGC.
Mm-hmm.
And that ended up getting a lot of eyes on it.
Right. Inviting Smash players, Super Smash Bros. Players to try their hand at Pokemon, competitive Pokemon. So stuff like that, very useful. Finding even just like one knowledgeable person to get other people involved, even just through a publicity event, very helpful for a scene.
Okay. I think that's about it.
All right. So now, before we get into our, competitive tips for the games that we are knowledgeable of, I would say the games that we play, but I don't play competitive Catan. I'm just a casual observing fan. But I've learned a couple things, but before we get into that, let's go through some quick plugs. You can hit us up on social media at Facebook and Twitter. Follow us and give us suggestions for topics you'd like us to discuss there. And that's BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. You can go to bgbcast.com. That's our website where we have all of our episodes posted and cataloged. If you're looking for a specific episode, you can go to the tags tab. That'll take you to a big page with tags of all the games. You can just control F the game that you want to hear our thoughts on and see if we have any episodes on it. If we don't, again, hit us up on our socials with that suggestion. You can find a link to our TeePublic store, teepublic.com/user/BGBcast, where we have merch with our cool logo on it. That does it for BG Bros plugs, so let's hear Matt plugs.
Oh, I just wanted to say our merch is a perfect gift for the BGB listener this holiday season.
For a BGB fan in your life, grab a t-shirt, hoodie, sweatshirt. All right. So yes, Matt plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/twack. I stream on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at about 1 p.m. Central Time to 4 p.m. Central Time, give or take. I stream a lot of roguelites, some competitive games, you know, platform fighters, strategy games, what have you. And I've also been streaming through Fortune Street, which is a ridiculous board game video game that's very fun and exciting and also very frustrating at times. You can also, through that Twitch page, find a Discord server where you can talk to me and Jeff and other fans of our work. You can also follow me on Twitter at MattCraigGaming, where I tweet out my stream, I tweet out random thoughts, and I also tweet out videos when I post them on my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/IEatAtSonic. It's an older username, but I can't change it because YouTube. I've been making video essays about video games, analyzing themes and design and ideas. I've been doing a long series on The Witness, and I should have a video coming out before the end of the year about Sonic Adventure. And then me and a friend of mine who was in a previous episode years ago on this podcast started a new podcast called Net Surfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web, where we analyze 21st century media. And our most recent episode from today was about the cartoon miniseries Over the Garden Wall. So if you're interested in that or interested in more media analysis that's not necessarily board games, then check that out, Net Surfer Pro, on all major podcasting apps now.
So if you didn't catch all that, that's Twack on Twitch, IEatAtSonic on YouTube, Matt Craig Gaming on Twitter, and Net Surfer Pro is Matt's other podcast.
Yeah.
For myself, you can just look me up on Twitter at Jeff Craig Designs, and you can also follow me on Twitch, twitch.tv/RadicalHawks. twitch.tv/RadicalHawkz. I stream when I stream, and when I do, it's usually some kind of strategy game or Pokemon or Teamfight Tactics or something like that. All right. So let's talk about competitive scenes and strategies of games that we are knowledgeable of. Would you like to start, or would you like me to start?
I'll go ahead and start. I think it'll be interesting to sort of compare how these games work.
Sure.
I personally feel like there's a lot of similarities in competitive gaming from one game to another, which actually technically is you know, something that helps you get good at multiple games. But so maybe you'll catch some things between us.
Sure.
So I've played competitive Dominion a fair amount. It's mainly organized through a forum, last I checked, the Dominion Strategy Forums. I could be wrong. I haven't been on that in particular in a few months or so. Maybe a year. I don't remember. But they use the Dominion Online, like, official client, which is very clean, very smooth, very easy to tell the board and see victory points and stuff, which is very nice. Dominion is, of course, a deck builder. The deck builder, I might say, which I will. It's the deck builder. It has a lot of, like, typical deck builder strategy, like remove cards from your deck that aren't good so you can get better cards. Where the competitive side comes in is that you can't just buy every card on the board that you want. There's big things to think about, like when your cards will get shuffled back into your deck. You know, you shuffle your cards and your discard into your deck whenever you run out of cards in your deck. So you have to consider that whenever you buy a card, you won't draw it until you shuffle back. So, like, the first two cards you buy, you won't get until the third turn at the earliest. And then from there, you have 12 cards in your deck, so it'll still be, like, three turns after that. But once you start getting, like, 15 cards, then the time it takes to shuffle all your cards back into your deck is even greater. And this especially comes into play when you draw a lot of cards, because you could shuffle your deck before you buy something good, and then you'll wait even longer before that good card goes into your deck. Whereas if you buy it without drawing more cards, then it'll likely just be shuffled in, and you might draw it next turn. Whereas in normal Dominion, you don't really have to think about that. In competitive levels, that's a pretty important factor, as well as just, like, not buying too many of a given card. You know, like, getting enough actions to play cards is important, but it's even more so when every action needs to be, like, carefully planned out. And you don't want too many cards that don't give you actions, because there's a chance you might draw them all. And, when you, like, see high-level players play, they'll very carefully consider, like, how many of a given card they'll need. Like, do they need four goons or three goons? Or how many villages do they need? That sort of thing.
Is there, like, a rule of thumb out there, perhaps, for, like, how much draw versus action versus money you should have in your deck?
It's really more about what engine you're going with. There are a lot of different, like, two-card combos that people have written about, in a lot of different sort of engines that way. So, like, if you're playing a deck based around the card Minion, which is a very good card, you probably want to get as many minions as you can.
Whereas, what does Minion do?
Minion is plus one action, and then plus two coins, I believe. And then you may discard your hand and draw five cards, and your opponent may discard their hand and draw four cards, I think. Something like that. Mm-hmm. So Minion's very strong because it lets you, like, it gives you money and it lets you cycle through your deck. So that's something that people play in a stack, because it's just, you buy a bunch of that card. But also, like, there could be a card like, what is it? Like, Goons is a good example. It's a very strong card that gives you plus one buy, I want to say plus three coins, and then whenever you buy a card this round, gain a victory point token. And Goons doesn't give you any actions, so getting, like, three or so is very good, because ideally you'd want to draw your whole deck and then play all three of them, so, like, you're not as worried about the consistency of, like, needing more Goons to draw them more likely. Instead, your main focus is on, like, getting actions and card draw to go through your deck quickly and then play all your Goons. There is a big element of, like, knowing cards that are very good and recognizing them on the board. I think Rebuild is the name of the card, or it might be Upgrade. I never remember which one's which, but it's a card that you play it, plus one card, plus one action, and then trash card, or it's name a victory card. Reveal cards from the top of your deck until you reveal a victory card with a different name than the one you named. Trash that card that you revealed and gain a victory card costing three more than it, or up to three more. So what that does is it turns your estates into duchies and duchies into provinces. And that card is very, very strong to the point where almost every game I've played where it's been on the board, both players have bought it as soon as possible. So like noticing that card and knowing that it's good is important. Same thing with what's it called? Tournament is another strong one where like knowing that it's good and then knowing the deck you build around it is important. These all are things that both you can sort of read up on. There's a lot of Dominion strategy articles and a lot of videos as well by a few different players like Adam Horton. But it's also something that you just sort of learn as you go. What is really interesting, though, to me is how important money is. I think it's very easy in Dominion to fall into the trap of like, there's a cool action here. I want to get that. But in competitive play, sometimes it's really good to just get a silver in one of your first buys because it makes your money a bit stronger in your second shuffle. And then a lot of times people will buy gold instead of buying a six cost action if it's like their first time getting six gold, because gold just lets you buy more gold quicker, and then that lets you buy more actions.
Yeah, it's like it speeds up your engine by having more gold in your deck than the next time you'll be able to buy something six. It'll come sooner, more likely.
The last main thing is that there are two victory like conditions in Dominion, or two endgame conditions. There is buying all of the highest victory point card, or buying all of three other piles. And piling out or getting three other piles is very good because it doesn't cost as much money. And so there are a lot of cards and a lot of decks that are very good at piling out. And knowing those is very strong because it lets you sort of surprise the opponent. Like, it's very easy to do the math of, like, I have 10 victory points, my opponent has 8. I can buy this many provinces and they won't be able to beat me with provinces. Whereas, like, piling out can come at a sudden moment. So cards like Ill-Gotten Gains is a pretty big one that I've seen. Or I think it's called Black Cat from Dominion Menagerie is a card that just piles on curses very quickly. Especially any card that adds curses can get rid of the curse pile very quickly, which then means that only two other cards need to be bought out. But like sort of knowing or paying attention to the size of piles lets you sort of pivot your strategy in a way that's hard to react to. And so one last thing is that this is something that we touched on in our Dominion episode from years ago. That's a long time. But in competitive Dominion, there's sort of three main types of decks. There's the slog deck, which aims to junk up your opponent's deck with garbage. There is the engine deck that aims to play a efficient combo of actions. And then there is the big money deck that gets a lot of money and then a lot of buys to buy multiple provinces in one turn. And knowing how those decks sort of function is a very good starting point because you might not know exactly what the good combos are, but you can be like, oh, this card gives me two actions. This gives me two cards. Maybe I can build an engine with that. Or this card adds two, what's it called? Ruins to your opponent's deck. Maybe that'll help me trash their deck out a bit. And so just sort of knowing how those different axes of speed work is very useful because you could always try it and experiment as long as you keep those in mind.
Those are some tips on competitive Dominion. Now I shall go over some tips on competitive Catan that I have learned from watching competitive Catan YouTubers. So I think the first thing to point out at the highest level of Catan is that table talk is still allowed at all stages of the game, including the initial settlement placement. So as early as the first placement of your first settlement, you can start to make deals with players if you're savvy. Although, you know, don't go deal crazy. I think the main thing to keep important when it comes to table talk and wheeling and dealing in competitive Catan is that politics play a part in it. And if you want people to make trades with you, then you got to show that you're, you know, trustworthy, or that you can make fair deals and you're not just, you know, just wheeling and dealing and trying to get the better of everybody else. That said, you know, if you trick someone into taking a bad deal, then that's ultimately on them for taking a bad deal. But, you know, just keep that in mind. If you want to make deals with players, you have to somewhat be on their good side. So anyways, as soon as your first placement of settlements, you can talk with other players. And I've seen players talk with each other about where they're going to place their settlement, just to maybe work against the player who placed their first settlement or their second settlement. If you think somebody has like too good of a position, then you can work with another player early on to try and set your settlements up to cut them off from like an even more powerful expansion. When you're placing your first settlement, the way that you can sort of assess the board is you want to identify clusters of synergistic materials or resources. So ore, wheat, sheep is the sort of trinity of resources that are very important, especially for cities and development cards, which are very important for winning the game consistently. And then wood and brick are good together. But not nearly as good as ore, wheat, sheep. If you have wood and brick plus sheep or plus wheat, those are good clusters of synergistic materials because you can buy roads and most of a settlement with those. So identifying those clusters and identifying which ones have the best probabilities, which are numbers 5 through 9. And then as players will place their settlements down, it's also important to identify rare resources. And this is something that comes from experience. But a rare resource is essentially one that doesn't have good numbers on it and/or other players aren't collecting a lot of it because they're either not touching any of the resource or the ones that they are touching have bad probabilities ascribed to them. And by controlling rare resources, then that means you can make deals later in the game that are more beneficial to you. Because like if you're the only player that can get any wood, then everyone's going to want to trade with you for your wood and you can get good deals that way. So placing your settlements on good clusters with synergy, with good resources is important early game. One last early game tip is you obviously get to place 2 settlements. And because it happens, you know, first player to fourth player placing the first settlement and then fourth to first reverse order placing your second settlement, it's just important to try and identify where the other players are going to place their settlements and have your second settlement in mind and make sure that your second settlement synergizes with your first settlement, either by having synergistic resources like ore, wheat, sheep, or by having synergistic numbers. Because having 2 settlements on different spaces with the same number means that every time that number is rolled, you get 2 resources. And if it's a synergy, that's very powerful. It's also important that they're on different spaces with the same number because a thief can't block either of them. So like if someone puts a thief on your 5 sheep, but you still have a settlement on a 5 stone, you're still getting resources on 5s. Oh, I guess one last thing is you can also put your pieces really close to your opponent's pieces. If a space is surrounded by 3 settlements, if one given territory tile is surrounded by 3 settlements, it's very unlikely that a thief will get placed on there because there's 2 other players that are trying to keep that space clear. So that's an important thing to note. As you play the game, trading is a very crucial part of the game, critical part of the game and strategy, and understanding like what constitutes a fair trade helps. But what helps even more is tracking your opponent's resources from turn to turn as best as you can to identify who has what resources and who needs what resources. Because if you're aware of what people have and what they need, then that means you can push better trades for yourself onto them. One aspect of trading that I hadn't considered until I started watching competitive Catan videos was the concept of stealing a trade. But it makes total sense that if two players are orchestrating a trade and they're about to commit to it, you can butt in with a better deal for the person, at least the side of the trade. I mean, the active player is the only one who gets to make the trade. It's just, is he going to trade with you or somebody else? But butting in that trade with a better deal for them, maybe a slightly worse deal for you, could be important just so that two players aren't benefiting. Rather, just the one player is benefiting from the trade. So stealing trades at the opportune moments is very good. One thing that I learned is that you should always buy development cards before you buy anything else on your turn, especially just because if you get the road building development card, then you don't want to be spending your resources on roads. Instead, you could just wait till the next turn so you can play the road building card, and then you would have saved your resources for something else. It's important to have fewer than 7 cards at the end of your turn. Almost always, like if you have a ton of resources, sometimes it's best to just trade them away 4 for 1, just so that you don't have 7 and you lose all those resources that you have in your hand. One thing that I didn't realize was just how strong ports were in Catan. When I played, you know, the last few times I played, I've tried port strategies and they didn't end up working. And I think probably the reason why that happened was because when you go for a port strategy, you still need to have strong resources, you know, diversified for everything else. You can't just tunnel on one resource for your port because, you know, you can 2-to-1 all of your resources for what you need if you happen to be rolling the right stuff. But it's much better for you to just have the resources rather than 2-for-1 them. Oh, putting one of your initial settlements on something that gives you wheat and stone is especially powerful. Because if you can make an early city, that it's sort of like the situation you described, Matthew, getting gold, and that how it that like it ramps up your engine, and then the next 6 gold that you get on a turn comes that much sooner. Same thing by having a settlement on stone and wheat, because you get that stone and wheat, you turn that city or that settlement into a city, and now you get stone and wheat even faster. Your next city comes even sooner if you upgrade your first city. Also, just getting an early city is strong because the way that the game works, every player's first 2 settlements are their best settlements. That's why you put them where you put them, because those are the best spaces on the board. So making them cities is just that much better. It's just making your best settlement even better. So early cities is good. And trading for the resources for early cities is crucial for winning. You pretty much always need to be either deciding whether you're going to go for longest road or longest army. Or largest army, not longest army. If you are going for longest road, you don't necessarily have to connect your 2 starting settlements. It can help if they're nearby each other so that you can connect them. But you don't want to use you don't want to use your early roads to try and connect them. You want to use your early roads to point in a direction for your next settlement. And you'll connect your starting settlements later if you have to. But you can get enough roads just building a loop around one of the tiles that your one of your starting settlements is on. So you really don't need that much room for longest road. And then as far as largest army, you need to have a really good ore wheat sheep to go for that strategy, because you obviously need a lot of development cards for the largest army. And it's harder to get that one, and it will be more contested by other players, most likely, depending on the board. But yeah, you need to at least go for one of them, because 2 free points is 1/5 of the points you need to win the game. Let's see. It doesn't hurt to just ask for trades, even before you're going to like port your resources at a port for a different rate. Like if you have a bunch of wheat and you have a 2-for-1 wheat port, you still might want to see if you can like trade the wheat for something else. Like if somebody desperately needs wheat, you might be able to get a 1-for-1 trade out there. Some players will make future trades or include trades for the future in part of their deals. So like you can say like, hey, I really need this resource now. I'll tell you what, if you give it to me now, the next time I roll any sheep, I'll give them to you for free. I'll give you one sheep for free. Some players will allow that. Okay, the last two things. First of them is a rule that I did not realize was a rule in Catan, but it makes somewhat sense. So, Matthew, are you familiar with the cards in Catan that just give you one victory point?
Yeah.
The development cards. So you actually don't have to play those to count those victory points. Oh. If you have enough points on your turn to win the game, including the victory point cards that you have in your hand, you can play all of them on the same turn.
Okay.
So yeah, that's one thing. I there might be some like corner case like scenario where it might be beneficial for you to play one of those cards instead of do anything else on your turn. But for the most part, you can just hold them in your hand and wait till the end of the game and then play them all at once. The last thing I have here is a little trick that players at high levels won't really fall for, but it's something that you can use to win games at lower levels of strategy in Catan. And that is the dirty Monopoly trick, where you make like a ridiculous, it doesn't even have to be ridiculous. It can be a sensible trade. You know, say you have a Monopoly card in your hand and you're looking to get all of the wheat on the table. You can trade your wheat away for something to a player and then Monopoly it back. So that's a little dirty trick you can try on some people, that they don't realize that you have a Monopoly card in your hand. Oh, speaking of, certainly at the table in like a physical game capacity, but also sometimes online, you can see relatively how many cards are left in a stack for like the five different resources. So if you do have a Monopoly in your hand, you can use that information to tell you whether it's a good time to play your Monopoly or not. You know, you can see that like there's only two cards left in the brick stack. So if I play Monopoly now, I'm going to get a lot of bricks. So yeah, that's the tips that I have for high level competitive Catan.
Interesting.
Any thoughts? Does it make you kind of want to play a game?
Maybe once.
Well, maybe we'll play a game online for free. We don't have to go hunting down another copy of Catan because it's been a while since we played it. But yeah, anything else to say about competitive board gaming scenes?
If you're like in a competitive scene for a board game we didn't mention, hit us up. I'd love to learn about more.
Yeah, if you're like a content creator or you know where we can go, I'm a big fan of just learning about competitive things.
Oh yeah.
And there's plenty of games that I don't play that I'm just a casual spectator fan of. So I'm more than happy to look further into it and learn the tips and tricks and maybe check it out someday.
Yep.
All right. Well, with that, thank you for listening to our episode on competitive board gaming scenes, and we'll see you next episode.
See ya.